and music of Leonard Bernstein we're listening to right now. It's 100 years since Leonard Bernstein was born. Actually, it will be in August. And the Shreveport Symphony is celebrating that with a performance this weekend. In fact, tomorrow, along with some other great American music and one non-American piece, but I think has similar inspiration in a lot of ways. Michael Butterman, music director of the Shreveport Symphony, in the studio with me here, and let's talk about it. I think it's going to be a spectacular concert.
I do too, absolutely. I'm looking forward to sharing a couple of familiar pieces and some less familiar music as well, and of course welcoming the Centenary College Choir and Prisma Vocal Ensemble, mm-hmm. and a fantastic boy soprano will be joining us as well. So a lot of forces allied to bring this music to our community. And you're right, the centerpiece of the concert is occasioned by the anniversary that we are recognizing this year, the 100th anniversary of the birth of Bernstein. The Chichester Psalms, you know, is a piece that he wrote in 65. He was taking a sabbatical, I think it was,
right. Yeah,
from his music directorship of the New York Philharmonic, and wrote this for a choral festival in England, Chichester Cathedral, and originally I think intended men and boys choir to be the...
Yeah, because that would have been the Anglican choir. So right. It was the choirs of Westminster, Salisbury, and Chichester.
Right.
So the three, and they were combined. I guess it was in the summer every year.
Must have been. But usually these days, especially in this country, done with mixed SATB...
Things have changed.
...choir. But this solo that's in the second movement, he really is insistent that it needs to be a... either a male alto or even better a boy soprano, sure. for the innocence of the text really that's there. So shall I describe the piece a little bit?
Well, sure.
I guess
absolutely.
I'm already doing it.
Yeah, it is, and it really this is one of the great works by Bernstein, if you don't know it, and certainly a great choral piece, and at least from my perspective, this is my favorite concert of the season, just because of all the music on there. And the Bernstein is certainly one of the reasons why.
Well, Bernstein, first of all, let's just back up a little bit and acknowledge that his contribution to music in the 20th century is almost hard to overstate. He was a significant composer, but a tremendously influential communicator about music. Was the first American conductor, I think it's fair to say, to have international acclaim and acceptance, and really very much championed the renewal of interest in the music of Gustav Mahler in particular, and of course was a great and tireless advocate for composers like Aaron Copland and I suppose Lucas Foss and Charles Ives to a certain extent as well. And his compositional output ranges from things like On the Town, Wonderful Town, On the Waterfront, and of course West Side Story, this fantastically iconic Broadway musical, to really intellectually dense and sometimes even abstruse compositional styles. His serenade for violin and strings and percussion, beautiful piece, but a very different kind of language than what you hear in West Side Story,
sure.
for example. And the Chichester Psalm somewhere in between. It's very, I think it's very melodic and tuneful, but yet it's got a lot of structural, I guess, interest and depth, and it's very much a piece that works on a both sort of superficial, beautiful level and also an interesting sort of deeper structural compositional level. So the piece is in three movements, not very long though, probably 23 minutes altogether, mm-hmm. something like this. And he uses several psalms, sometimes combining texts. The first movement is essentially the psalm that talks about make a joyful noise unto the Lord, all ye lands, enter into his presence with thanksgiving. And so there's a great deal of celebration. There are tremendous percussion sounds, lots of clanging and jingling of bright percussion colors, and a generally upbeat kind of...
We just heard the beginning of it there.
Yum, bum, 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 one, two, one, two, one, two, three, and it's sort of Bernstein's almost trademark asymmetric pattern rhythmically there. But the second movement, though, is maybe the emotional heart of the piece. We have this setting of the Psalm 23 text, "The Lord is my shepherd," which is the one that is sung by the boy. And I should add, this is all being done in Hebrew,
right?
And so it's really lovely, and it's a challenge, you know, for orchestra, for choirs rather, that are not used to singing in Hebrew terribly often. But this text is set very calmly and simply and slowly. And by the time he gets about halfway through the text of the psalm, he's interrupted by the men of the orchestra and the percussion with the psalm that says, "Why do the nations so furiously rage together?" Mm-hmm. The text that probably people recognize from Messiah, if they know that bass aria. And that music is much more turbulent, of course, and aggressive. And then the sopranos and altos come back in, and they're sort of floating above this turbulence. So we've got the two different threads at the same time, this sense of smooth and calm, and underneath this sort of broiling, bubbling tension. And the piece ends with a bit of a question mark. The boy soprano comes back in, but then there's a sort of strong, aggressive hit at the end. Yeah. So you're not quite sure. Well, it's a bit of a cliffhanger, I guess, musically speaking. But then it leads you into the third movement, which begins with a kind of a recapitulation of some of the themes from the first and the second movements that the strings play, kind of an extended prelude. And then this beautiful melody in 10-4, another sort of unusual rhythmic pattern.
Sure.
that is just so smooth and flowing. The harp starts it off, but then the choirs come in, and it's... the text is, you know, behold how, let's see, how good and pleasant it is, am I right, for brethren to dwell together in unity, if I'm not mistaken, Psalm 133. And in a way, that's Bernstein's, I would say, his appeal to the world to simply get along, I think.
Sure.
And at the end, the word unity is reached, and we have this nice sort of octave. It almost sounds like a unison in the choir to represent that the sense of being together. Really beautifully effective piece. Kind of unusually scored, strings and trombones, trumpets, percussion, but no woodwinds,
yeah.
No horns. So it's a little bit of a, almost a Stravinsky kind of like color in some ways. But really one of my favorite pieces, and I'm glad we're able to,
yeah.
to do it.
You know, it's interesting because you're talking about the different styles within it, the different moods.
Yeah.
So if you ever have the opportunity to read some of Bernstein's letters going back and forth, so I think it's William Hussey, Dean Hussey anyway, that he was the very reverend at Chichester,
uh-huh.
that was requesting, asking Bernstein if he would mind composing a piece, and then about a year later reminds him, oh, the festival's coming up in about, you know, 6 months, can you still write the piece? And he writes back and says, well, I think I have found the idea to do it, but the catch is it's going to be in Hebrew, so that's one of the things.
Right.
They did not that mind doing that, but in the initial letter it said it would be great if you can include a little bit of your West Side Story feel in it. So in his response back, when once he's decided on the piece, he says, and it does have a little bit of West Side Story there. The thing is he actually quotes two of his musicals in it. That gorgeous second movement, that beautiful theme,
yeah.
is from a musical that flopped for him, The Skin of Our Teeth. And it's, I mean, note for note, you would never realize that it came from a different source, but and it's weird to hear the original version, and it's like nothing compared to what he did,
yeah.
With this. But then the other section that precedes that is from the original prologue that he was going to use for West Side Story, a song called Mix.
I know this very well.
Okay,
yeah. This is a piece. So you're right. That the lama
yeah, yeah.
lama
right.
Mix, make a mess of them.
Right,
the
exactly.
SOBs pay, which I can't.
Yes,
even say.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes. This is okay. So I was in Bernstein's apartment in the Dakota like 20 some years ago now, and I was working on this 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, and the archivist brings out this manuscript and says, "What is this?" And I looked at it and I said, "It looks like Chichester Psalms, but I don't recognize these words." And he said that, you know, this was cut. So it was going to be like the they actually talk in West Side Story about mixing it up, I think is the idea.
That's it.
Between the Jets and the Sharks. And there's a great example. I mean, like, composers have always done this, right? They've found ways to repurpose things, especially things that maybe didn't make it to...
Right. And it might have been okay had it remained in the West Side Story show,
right.
but in Chichester Psalms, this... part of this great masterpiece.
Yeah, but I didn't realize that about the melody on top of that, basically the boy soprano melody.
Yes, that's exactly it. And somewhere online you can find someone singing the original words to it. It's like no, it makes more sense. And at least in my mind, I'm thinking of Bernstein, his spiritual side,
right.
which to some extent those words, that have nothing to do with the psalm at all, are sort of like that. But it's very different. Anyway, it's always kind of fascinated me, that part of it. And then the other thing is a letter that Bernstein wrote to the New York Times about the piece.
Uh-huh.
And he was basically complaining about how contemporary music was going off into, you know, it was the end of tonal music.
Then
at the very end, and that was one of the notes, I was looking around for my notes here, because he writes a little poem at the end of it about this being his child, and it stands sweetly alone on its two tonal feet. And it's just like, you can write great music. You didn't call his piece great, but this contemporary work that was written in a tonal landscape instead of going off in directions that, you know, we're already starting to bother him.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's really interesting because, you know, this was written in 65, right? So that is a time, to put it in some context, when this would have been very much out of place for a new work that would be taken seriously by the Academy, so to speak.
Sure, yeah, exactly.
Because, you know, where's the serialism? Where's the, you know, the atonality? Where's the, you know, any sense of 12-tone writing? And it wasn't here. And, of course, this is something that he... you know, that's a style he could write, and you know, as I said, sort of did make some experiments compositionally in you know, a lot of different styles. But you know, the Norton lectures that he delivered at Harvard were sort of all about, in a sense, the idea that, frankly, there is something he felt sort of. Yeah, what's the word? Just that we are, human beings are going to be ultimately attracted to tonal music because it's based on the principles of physics.
Yeah.
And the notion of, you know, the primacy of certain overtones within, you know, the fifth is always going to be the most prominent overtone of any single pitch that we hear and things like this. You can take that or leave that, but I think if you listen to the music that is being written by most composers today, it sounds in some ways a lot more like the Chichester Psalms than it does, well, music by, who shall I say? Dalla Piccola, Boulez.
A lot of other composers.
Boulez
is a good example. Exactly that. So we have this great Bernstein piece on the concert, and then one of his friends, Aaron Copland's music as
yes.
well.
Yes. So, well, first of all, these are Psalms that Bernstein set, and we are not playing any psalm setting by Aaron Copland, but instead we are playing music from his opera, The Tenderland, which is not often presented, frankly, but there are a few moments from it that are pretty well known, including some choral versions of some of the sections. The piece that we are playing is actually a suite, love theme basically to begin with, and which is about 10 minutes long, and then the party scene, which is a lot like choral piece Stomp Your Foot, if anybody who's a choral singer out there may know that one, and then we close with The Promise of Living, which in the original orchestral suite is simply played by the orchestra. We are, since we have a chorus there, we're going to involve them in this, and this is as close to a sort of hymn. If a psalm is a hymn of praise or a maybe even a prayer to some extent, this is kind of an American affirmation of how to go forth in life, and so it struck me as at least conceptually similar to some of the sentiments expressed in Psalms.
Well, the opera is about a farm family.
Yes.
And it's, I don't recall that it's exactly set in the Depression era, but it's inspired by the Depression.
Very much, yes.
And people banding together.
Right. And this is all about, yes, come brothers and sisters, we're going to, you know, we're going to make it, and but we do it together, yeah. And it's really just it's very life affirming, this choral finale that we're going to be presenting. So I thought that would because of course I think of Bernstein and Copland almost like you think of one thinks of I don't know. Brahms and Dvorak, or Mahler and Bruckner, or
something. Yeah, they kind of go hand in hand.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah, that's true. And that ending that you're talking about, I mean, it's one of Copland's more beautiful moments. He has tons of them, of course, throughout his music, but you can't help but be moved and inspired by it. I think
so too. And then you know, we're opening with a piece I'm sure no one here is very familiar with, by Alan Hovhaness.
Who studied with Copland.
That I didn't know.
Yeah, student of Copland. I'll tell you a little more in a minute.
Okay.
Well, I know this because all of this, you know, this focusing on New England, New York, Boston, and all of that.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, I mean, that's where I went to school. We had a Hovhaness wing in the conservatory library there. So all kinds of little Hovhaness tidbits I have, for better or worse.
I should turn it over.
I don't know how valuable any of them are, but I did know that.
Excellent. Well, the piece we're playing to open the concert is called Psalm and Fugue. It's just string orchestra, and it's as the title suggests, it's in two movements, a textless psalm, and then a fugue, which is an imitative piece where there's a theme that is then sort of or a subject rather that is then answered, and it's a technique that people will recognize from Bach and Baroque composers, but it's just it's rather understated, that whole piece, rather. I would say kind of meditative, especially the first movement. Really just, I think, a nice calming way to open. Now, this is a composer that many of our listeners may not be that familiar with. He has I think it's probably his best known work is Mysterious
Mountain,
his second symphony. Yeah. His second of 67 numbered symphonies.
He was a busy guy.
He wrote a lot of music.
He wrote a lot of them.
Yeah, and just died, you know, only 18 years ago. It was, 1911 to 2000, I think, were his his dates. But, I mean, you can...
I mean, he died with the millennium. But the thing is it's interesting about him. So, you know, I forget what year the second symphony comes from, but that was the piece that essentially launched the rest of his compositional career and made him really well known. So that's the second out of 67.
Right.
So most of his work is done after this particular period. So he studied with Copland, who wasn't terribly impressed.
Really?
And basically said, you need to go back and figure out who you are. And Hovhaness went and destroyed most of his earlier music. Now, for some reason, the Psalm and Fugue survive, because that's from 1941. So that's the earlier period.
Yeah.
And yet, it's funny to me because all the later music, when he started going back to his Armenian roots, and then the spirituality that's in so much of his music.
Yes,
I mean,
yes.
It really focuses on the spiritual. And yet, this is his pre-spiritual time, and yet it's a Psalm at the beginning. So clearly, he was leaning in that direction before
always.
We got there.
Yeah.
But that's the thing I always noted. It's like, well, he studied with Copland, but Copland was like, "Yeah, go back to the, And I guess from that standpoint, it was good advice, because then once he did that and rediscovered his whatever his focus was going to be, that launched the rest of it and all those other pieces. That you're right. It's not as well known as some, but then God created great whales.
Yes,
and
that's another
like
one.
That.
Is, yeah. But you're right, that advice to figure out who you are that sounds like echoes of Nadia Boulanger, which who was Copland's teacher, and the sort of advice that she gave to a number of her students, including Astor Piazzolla and so on. So in any case, it seemed to work out relatively well in the case of Hovhaness, ultimately, anyhow. And then, to close the concert, we have something, now for something completely different.
Well, it's not American, but it does have psalms.
It does. So we are playing what we call the Russian Easter Overture, and by Rimsky-Korsakov. I say what we call because I believe the translation of the title from Russian is Bright Holiday, and it is a piece that was inspired by Easter morning services at Orthodox cathedrals in St. Petersburg, it comes from the same period of as Capriccio Espanol and Scheherazade, and has this certain the percussion writing is very similar, I think, in a lot of ways. It's very sort of energetic and successful piece at the end. Earlier on, a little more sort of meditative, and he has a beautiful trombone solo, actually a second trombone solo, rather unusually. The idea, though, is that he is taking chant melody from the Eastern Orthodox Church and actually quoting three different canticles.
Right.
And you can hear that pretty clearly, especially when the trombone is playing this melody that I mentioned. It sounds just like a sort of a Russian baritone. But even the very, very beginning, which is just the flutes, oboes, clarinets, that is also a chant melody. And you can kind of hear it's in 5-4, so it feels a little asymmetric. But that's to match the you know, the way that even Gregorian chant has that same kind of sort of asymmetric feel. It's all about the how the text flows and where the stressed syllables are and
sure.
So on. So combining the melodic inspiration from the Eastern Orthodox Church with the what Rimsky-Korsakov described as the I think the brightness of a lot of the pagan celebration of spring that he witnessed around that time gives us a piece that has both these spiritual overtones as well as a lot of just celebration sounds, bells pealing, and just, you know, bright trumpety kinds of fanfares. A piece that I think people will probably recognize at least portions thereof.
Think so.
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't done it since I've been here, but it seems like a piece that maybe used to get done a little more than.
It's kind of fallen by the wayside.
Yeah.
I'm not sure why.
Yeah.
In some ways, it's like a mini Scheherazade, even though the themes are totally different because you stop, and let's have a little solo here, and stop and have a little solo here before it starts kicking along. But it's exciting. Now, my own experience, I remember that from high school playing in Allstate.
Oh yeah,
youth
yeah.
orchestras. Although it's a big piece for that, I think, because it's just so exciting. And by the time you're at the end, you know, it's you know, that brightness you're talking
right.
about is part of the piece. But I think people will know it. You're right. I don't recall that we've done it in many years here.
Right.
Yeah, but it's still one of those standard works.
It seemed like a way of complementing this other music, but giving us something rather different at the same time. But, you know, a similar kind of inspiration. And, of course, we're coming up on our own Easter season here just before Palm Sunday. I realize Russian Orthodox Easter is, I believe, this year a week later, but nonetheless.
it's in the spirit
of
the
season. It's
vaguely
seasonal, yes.
There we go. That's right. So all of this that we've been talking about, this tremendous concert, is tomorrow night. It's at 7:30, Riverview Theater in downtown Shreveport. And, of course, for tickets, you can go to ShreveportSymphony.com. That's one of the easiest ways. You can call 318-227-8863. And at least from my perspective, if you have not, for whatever reason, never attended a concert by the Shreveport Symphony, or for whatever reason, this is the one to go to, because it at least for my, you know, it's in my personal preferences coming out. I love this concert. I really do. It's amazing music, top to bottom.
Yeah.
And very exciting. I mean, and the you know, the Russian Easter Overture ending the concert. I mean, this ends huge and fast with, you know, lots of notes in the orchestra. It's a very exciting piece.
What's not to like?
Yeah, well, nothing.
Yeah, right.
Absolutely.
No, I think you're right. There's a nice arc to the concert itself, and a lot of really uplifting, I would say, music along the way,
and two very fine choirs. Along
for
with
sure.
The orchestra.
Yeah, they sound terrific, and really, really looking forward to the evening. So we hope that everybody listening now will join us.
So again, tomorrow evening, 7:30 p.m., Riverview Theater. And again, tickets and information at ShreveportSymphony.com or 318-227-8863. Michael Butterman, thank you, as always, for coming into the studio.
My pleasure.
And joining
thank
me
you.
And break a leg tomorrow. And if you're with an organization and you have an event coming up and would like to be featured on a future spotlight, get in touch with us at 800-552-8502.
There you go.